Welcome to TFP, the Theater Folk Podcast. I'm Lindsay Price, resident playwright for Theater Folk. Hello. I hope you're well. Thanks for listening. Okay, before we get going, I have to mention the free, that's right, free drama teacher training we're offering this week, Saturday, November 9th at 12 noon Eastern Standard Time, called The One Technique You Need to Be a 21st Century Drama Teacher. Okay, that's a mouthful, but the title says it all. 21st century skills, they're becoming necessary for today's teacher. But what if you don't have time to become a technology expert? And how could you ever keep up with students who eat, sleep, and breathe technology? And what do drama and technology have in common anyway? You know, are we all going to sit in front of our computers and do improv games? So this training is just for you. I'm going to show you what you need to be tech savvy in the classroom with specific exercises for drama teachers, and I promise this workshop is 100% technobabble free. All you need is access to the internet. Go to 21drama.com, that's the number 21, 21drama.com, and register for this free training now. You do not want to miss out. So today we have an interview with another one of our authors, John Donald O'Shea, who goes by Don. And Don has three plays with us, a classic melodrama with a modern twist called Little Nell and the Mortgage Foreclosure, a full-out modern melodrama called The Revolting Cheerleaders, and a lovely gem of a Christmas play called The First Herald Angel. Don has had such an interesting journey along his playwriting path, of which the takeaway is it's never too late to start writing, and everyone can find that doorway into their creative side. Okay, so take it away, Don. Hello, everybody. I am here with one of our playwrights. I have John Donald O'Shea. Now, you go by Don, is that right?
Yes, I do. And I think I was one of your first playwrights, wasn't
I think you were, too. We've got three of your plays. We have Little Nell and the Mortgage Foreclosure, The Revolting Cheerleaders, which is one of my favorite titles, and The First Herald Angel.
I think you're correct.
Good. It always embarrasses me when I get names of titles of other people's works wrong.
Because you were my first publisher, I always send my plays to you first. Whether you use them or not is up to you. But I've always respected the fact that you were the first guy to put me on the map, and I like to send my stuff to you first. So that's kind of how I operate.
That's awesome. Okay, well, that's the first thing I want to talk to you about is – before you started writing plays, you had a pretty different life.
I had a very different life.
Tell everybody what was your job? What did you
use? Well, I started out as a young assistant state's attorney. I graduated from that. I became the city attorney of Moline, Illinois, and about 4 years later, in 1974, I was elected a circuit judge, and I did that for 26 years. In Illinois, you don't run for re-election on a partisan ballot. You run on a retention ballot, and I was retained four times. You have to run every 6 years. Right. So that's what I did.
So where does playwriting fit into this?
It all came about when I was a member of the board of directors of the Quad City Music Guild. They, in those days, produced three musicals each summer, and were looking for a way to raise some extra funds. And we had been doing a winter show, and the returns on that were diminishing. And I one night said at a board meeting, you know, we're spending thousands of hours on these off-season shows and making $2,000. Why don't we try some mini shows? We'd probably do better. And one of the women on the board suggested that I come up with the right mini show. And I went to the library and looked for a melodrama, couldn't find any, discovered at that time that the libraries threw out their old books. So I decided to write one. And I wrote what ultimately became the first part of Little Nell and the Mortgage Foreclosure. I ultimately added two other sections to it to make it the play that you now see it. The great thing about theater, it's all creativity. And that's what I think is fun about it.
Now, you've had a long history with theater. I saw in your bio that you've been involved with community theater since the 60s.
Yeah, in 67, I did my first role at the Quad City Music Guild. I had never been involved in theater in high school or college. And I came down and began working in the state's attorney's office. And the state's attorney's wife knew that I sang, and she said, you ought to go out and audition at the Music Guild. And I did, and that first summer I had two roles, probably the best summer I ever had out there. I ended up Bud Frump in How to Succeed in Business and Lun Ta in King and I. And that got it started, and I've been going ever since.
So what was the bug that caught you? What was it about theater that really spoke to you?
I love the old operettas. What I used to study in law school in my room, many times I would have the Reader's Digest Treasury of Operetta on softly in the background. And I just liked Naughty Marietta and Vagabond King and Merry Widow and many of the other old operettas. And I always wanted to do those things. And I guess the closest I ever got was doing the more modern pieces at the Music Guild.
Right. So Little Nell was your first play. When did you write that?
I think the 1990s. It's so long ago. You know, I actually wrote it probably 10 years before you saw it, because I did it for a couple of years as a little one-act, 15-minute play, and then we did it so often that I figured I had to write some more stuff so that when the same people called us up, we could perform for them again. And that's how I began writing more and more plays, and that's how I developed the second and the third segments of Little Nell. So that's how it came.
Even though it was quite a long ago, do you have any memories of what it was like to move through the writing process that very first time?
I don't think it's ever changed very much for me. I've always kind of begun the process with an idea. It might be I want to write a bit of autobiography. It might be I want to write a biography or write about an event. Or maybe somebody tells me a joke that I would like to expand into a full-length play or story. And that's kind of how it's always gone. I get this germ of an idea. I sit down, and then I try to bring in some characters, and I start writing.
Do you write with pen and paper first?
No.
Oh, you just start on the computer.
Yeah, I do, because it's so much easier to make changes.
Right. That's awesome. I always have to start with pen and paper, and then I know when I get tired of the writing, I'm like, okay, now I'm ready to move on to computer.
How can you work with a pen and paper? It seems that you would have to be crossing out and rewriting and using different sheets of paper. To me, the advantage of the computer is if I don't like something, I can delete it and away I go again.
You know what? It's always my initial output where I'm just sort of, things are just sort of coming out of my head. Uh-huh. I don't know why. It's pen and paper just is, that's what works for me. I think it's awesome if you can just get into the computer in the get-go. You're totally right. I once it's in the computer, though, I very rarely stray away from that. I always sort of do reworks exclusively on the computer.
Yeah, that's true with me too.
So once you have something, do you have a trusted reader that you give it to, or do you bring it right to your community group, or what's the next step for you?
Well, when I write something, I just sent you something which you'll be reading in a while.
Yes.
That thing has been on my desktop for probably 3-4 months in various forms. And I write a little bit, and then I go back and revise it a little bit. Then I add something, and I delete something. And, you know, I keep puttering with it for a period of a couple, 3-4 months. And then eventually I do very much like to take it to one of the theater groups I work with. Presently I'm directing theater for the junior high at Jordan Catholic at Rock Island. In the spring I'll do the same thing at Seton Catholic in Moline. This fall I also am going to use one of my pieces at Ollivan High School, which is a Catholic high school at Rock Island. And we're going to use probably a few of the pieces I've previously written at Edison Junior High in Rock Island. So, yeah, I test drive them either at the junior high level or at the high school level. And then you'll find out, regardless of how hard you work to make your writing perfect, that you leave the Y off an occasional they, you just have misspellings and typos. And by the time I send them to you guys, I like to think I've kind of eliminated most of those little bitty glitches.
Right. And also that you've, since you've got it on its feet, you know, you've heard what it sounds like when with working with the kids, you know what it looks like. That's always the best thing, because that's what theater is, right? It's live.
But yeah. What happens so often is a kid will bungle a line and it'll be funny.
Yeah.
Change the line to the way he bungled it. Or a kid will get a bright idea. Can we try this? Yeah, put it in, see what happens. And you like it, and you delete something else, and you put in what the child or the student gave you. And suddenly you got a better piece of work.
What do you like about working with students?
The ability to teach.
Yeah.
I am a superb teacher.
Awesome.
Of all the theater directors I've ever worked with, I teach the kids more than anybody else I've ever seen.
Why?
I teach them how to use their voices. I teach them how to use their bodies, their hands, their facial expressions. This is where I excel. And the younger they are, the better I can work with them. It's very hard for me to work, say, at the Quad City Music Guild directing when I direct there, because all the actors you meet on stage there feel they know more than you do. So you kind of let them do their own thing, and you just basically shape slightly around the periphery. And by and large, they do know as much or more than you do. But when you're working with sixth graders who are coming on the stage for the first time, that's where you can shape them right off the bat. It's customary, my friend, to face forward when you're delivering your lines. They have to be loud enough so the audience could hear you, and so on.
What's your favorite thing that you like to teach like sixth graders? What's your favorite thing when you got a new group coming in? What do you like to teach them right off the bat?
I like to teach them to use their voices. I try and tell young actors that there are four things you can do to make your voice more interesting. First, you can get louder or softer. Secondly, you can go faster or slower. Thirdly, you can change the pitch of your voice. You can take it down or up. And fourthly, and the most important thing, is you have to interject the emotion into your voice, the laughter, the anger, the mocking, whatever. And once they begin to catch on to that and begin to realize that they want to change their expression, almost from sentence to sentence and sometimes from clause to clause, that's where they learn to act. And the great thing about doing your own plays is you know how it should sound because you hear it in your own mind as you write it. And then you should be able to communicate that. It's not enough, of course, when you're working with a young actor to say, oh, that was awful. If you do that, you're a lousy director. You have to not only explain that what they're doing isn't working, but you have to show them how to do it. And the kids that have a modicum of talent will pick up on that. And within a very short time, they become very proficient actors. When I've directed at Seton, many of the kids there have gone on to Alleman High School. And over the 4, 5, 6 years I've worked with them, many of them are as good as the adults I work with in community theater elsewhere.
Yeah.
They become quite proficient at what they do.
So what do you do? So what would you say would be a good piece of advice to give to a teacher who perhaps is working with some kids who don't have a modicum of talent, that they're struggling? What would be a good piece of advice for a young director to give working with young students who just aren't getting it?
I think the most dangerous thing they can do is pick a play where the kids are basically playing themselves. That never forces the student to get beyond himself and to start acting. This is why I like melodramas and farces so much. I think it forces the actor to go beyond himself, to assume a character, and perhaps even become a caricature. And this, once they get the feeling of getting beyond themselves and taking the risks, that's when they start to act.
Awesome. So what is over the years now, so you've had now some exposure to theater and a lot of theater. What do you think now that this is sort of your life, right? Did you imagine that this would be what you would be doing when you retired?
Absolutely not. I had a friend named Judy Tumbleson. I think I mentioned her at your Little Nell, maybe, in the introduction. Judy was involved with a Lights on Learning program at Edison Junior High in Rock Island, and she decided she wanted to do some theater for the kids, and she asked me to become involved, and that's how I got involved with the junior highs. And I've now been involved with 3 junior highs and 2 high schools, as well as community theater. I still act a lot. I've been getting the best reviews I've ever gotten in my life. I just did a piece out at the Richmond Hill Barn Theater in Geneseo, Illinois, a full-length melodrama, and I got rave reviews, and I loved it. I had more fun doing that piece than anything I've ever done. So, yeah, theater has become a large part of my life, as well as writing my op-eds for the newspapers, I'm a political op-ed writer, and I write rather conservative stuff, and right now they're taking me to task for it, which is okay.
That's not bad. It means it keeps you on your toes, right? You never get complacent.
Well, I think if you're going to avoid getting senile and getting Alzheimer's, it's very good to keep your mind active. And for that reason, about 3.5 years ago, I took up playing the cello. And I religiously practice that every day. And I'm slowly but surely getting better at the cello. I was very fortunate. I worked for the state of Illinois. They provided me with a terrific pension when I retired after 26 years. And I have the time and the money to do the things I want to do. You know, I don't have to go to a school and say, hey, you got to finance this production. I can pay for it if I want to, and I frequently do. The piece we're going to do at Alamut, they won't have any expenses whatsoever with that. And that's largely because, I've been fortunate in my life. The public kept me in office for 26 years, and they gave me a good pension. And sometimes you have to be thankful.
Well, that balance is one of the hardest things when to be a working playwright, is to write the things that you love to do and want to do, but then, try to figure out how to pay the mortgage and the bills and raise a family and so on. It really must feel very freeing to just be able to write what you want, and to also to get it out there and put it on its feet without worrying.
It is. Anybody who's ever been a playwright is going to deal with various companies, perhaps theater folks, perhaps one of your competitors. It's hard, especially hard when you're a young playwright. You've had a little success with a company, and suddenly you send them something and they turn it down, and suddenly you're hurt. And you think, this is my best work ever. How dare they do this? What's wrong with these people? And, of course, you and Craig probably get buried with plays every year, and you have to make choices. And then suddenly, even though you may have turned it down or Big Dog may have turned it down, I submit it to somebody else, and they take it. And I say to myself, aha, I was right. This is a good play. We have our moments of great triumph when you guys publish for us, and then we have our moments of great defeat when you send out something and you think, this is the best thing I've ever read, and 9 companies turn it down, and finally the last one you send it to takes it. And that's what happened to me, exactly what happened to me with the play I call The Day Moz Boys Came to Town to Rob the Bank Again. I thought it was a terrific play, and everybody turned it down. And then the very last one I knew, I sent it to them, and they almost grabbed it overnight. They liked it so much. So you just don't know what's going to happen in this business. It's a very iffy business.
It's really that's the thing, is that I try to tell playwrights that there are other reasons other than the quality of the play that go into whether or not it's a fit for our catalog. And I think that what you just said, perseverance is really the best piece of advice to give to any playwright. First of all, you have to believe in your work.
I agree with you. And
you can't give up. And we're in an age where there aren't just 1 or 2 or 3 publishing companies. There are 10 and 15 and 20 with the internet, and they are all growing in their own respectability. There are places now where people can go and have a home.
Well, I think that's right. My home is all over the place on the internet. I think I've published with 6 or 7 publishing companies at the minute. And I really would like to be like Craig Sedaris or one of these other prominent writers, Tim Kelly, who has all of his stuff with one place so people could find it more easily. But that, for that reason, I've created my own website. And if somebody comes to O'Shea'sPlays.com, then I, you know, I refer them back to Theater Folk or Big Dog or whoever else my publisher may be. And, it's really kind of fun when you have the website and you start out getting something like 50 visitors a month. And within a couple of years, you're getting 700 a month, 800 a month. And maybe it doesn't immediately pay off in sales. But I suspect that at some point in time, if you get enough visitors, you're going to get more sales.
So what do you on that note, how has technology helped you? Is it something that it's been hard to get into? You said before we started, this was your very first Skype conversation. So how does technology, being a playwright, how do you use technology?
Well, once you kind of catch on to it, it's kind of nice. I mean, you guys on your website post, I forget the names of all of them. You use so many different vehicles to promote the plays.
Right.
I mean, any playwright who's got an iota of sense has to like that. He says, gee, they're getting this stuff out there. And that's really what you want your publisher to do. It doesn't do any good to put it in a printed catalog anymore. The hardest thing in the world, I think, is to evaluate a play from a printed catalog, one paragraph. The idea that you people at Theater Folks had of, you know, putting perhaps a half to two-thirds of the play online so that somebody could instantly peruse it, I think is a wonderful idea. And that's what I think sells plays, because the drama teacher at any particular junior high catches his name and says, I wonder what this is all about. And suddenly it's all there for him because you guys took the time. The other thing I've always liked about Theater Folk, better than any of my other publishers, is your online service, where if somebody buys a script or pays a royalty, I immediately get notice of it. And then I can check it out on your website just equally as easily. And, that's neat. Some of my publishers don't do that. And it's kind of frustrating. You never know if you sold a play with them until right. You happen to check the internet and you see somebody's doing it. And I like to patrol the internet, because every so often somebody will take unfair advantage.
That's right. It's always that moment when you're like, oh, aha, I've got you. There are very few places to hide these days. And I think that's just going to become the online stuff is just going to become more and more a part of our common world. And in terms of publishing, it's something that we need to address and find a way to make it work for us and for our playwrights and for you. And I think that if you're going to be a playwright in the next 5 years, 10 years, it's something that you can't ignore, right?
I don't think you can. I think you want to get as much exposure for your work as is reasonably possible. And you guys using the social media, do that for us. I think that's very important to the playwright. If your piece just ends up being mentioned as a one-inch blurb in a written catalog, the odds of anybody finding it, I think, are rather minuscule in this day and age. When you say there are 15 publishers and they each have a published catalog of 100, 200, 300, nobody has time to go through that. So what you people do with your social networking really, I think, is to the advantage of the playwright.
Ah, you say all the nicest things.
Well, I'm trying. But I think of all the companies I've worked with, your related services are the best, and your royalties are the best. One of the reasons, besides being loyalty, they always send my plays to you first, even if you don't use them, is because you pay a better royalty. And that's any playwright who is happy with 50% when he can get 70% is goofy. So you might as well go with the company that treats you the best.
Well, and it's it's in our best interest to treat you the best. All right, so where do you see this all going, Don O'Shea? For you as a playwright, where do you see yourself? What's your ideal life as a playwright?
Well, I would like to see just one of my plays get really popular. and that I could make a lot of money at it. But, you know, I'm getting older, and maybe one of these days this whole thing goes to my daughter. I've got a young daughter, not so young anymore. She's 27, Notre Dame graduate, theater major, trying to make her career in theater up in Chicago. And maybe, you know, she's around playwright. She's around community theater. She's been doing some professional theater. Maybe she picks up my website and my royalty rights for my plays. So down the road, I'm just hoping that one of them gets popular. And I think if one gets popular, a whole bunch will follow. I think my plays basically are crisply written. When I first started writing plays, there were a lot of paragraphs in my dialogue. Paragraphs pretty much are a thing of the past with me now. I generally write in one or two sentence paragraphs, very short, and keep the dialogue moving between the characters. And I find I like this better, and I think it works better for the kids. It's easier for them to memorize.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much. This has been a lovely conversation. This is the first time. Is this the first time that we have actually spoke?
I think this is the first time I've ever spoken to you.
I think so.
I'm not sure. Maybe I've spoken with him once or twice. I got one publisher that calls me once in a while, but it's pretty rare that your publisher ever calls you up and talks to you. I get a kick out of my daughter's theatrical agents. The first couple she had never came to see one of her performances. And I used to say to her, how the heck can these people represent you if they don't know what you're like, if they've never seen you perform? And I really think it's good that the publishers take a little time, even if it's only a minute or two, and talk to their playwrights and find out a little about the people. And then maybe they find something else to plug and something that's good for both.
I love that. I think that's a really good note to end on. So, before we go, let's do some theater folk news. It's a play feature, it's a play feature, it's time to feature a play. So Don O'Shea has three plays with us, as I said at the beginning, and as we're heading into the holiday season, which I think is crazy, I think it's like it's at the beginning of November. Why are the stores already in Christmas mode? It's drives me nuts. So, but I wanted to share with you a selection from Don's play, The First Herald Angel. So, on the very first Christmas Eve, a shepherd comes across a child who states that she is practicing to be a herald angel. The shepherd wants to believe, but his wife has a lot of doubts. So, we start with James, the shepherd, and Susanna is his wife. Susanna, guess what? The Savior is to be born tonight in Bethlehem, and his name will be Jesus. Really? Where did you get that? The angel told me. What angel? That one. James, you old fool, that's nothing but a child. But she says that she's an angel. If I told you I were an angel, would that make me one? No, my love. I would never believe that you're an angel. Then don't be so gullible. Would you have believed her if she said she was a bear? No. But I would have believed you. Then why would you believe a silly child? Oh, perhaps because I want the Messiah to come. Perhaps because she seems to be sincere. I always tell the truth. You do, eh? Just what sort of angel are you? I'm a guardian angel, but I was practicing to be a herald angel. And just what does a guardian angel do? We guard the children of God committed to our care. I'm a child of God. Do I have a guardian angel? Sure. All humans do. Well, mine must be as worthless as my husband, or else I would not be living in a squalid cave surrounded by bleeding sheep and married to a penniless shepherd. We merely guard and guide. We don't provide free housing. I love that line. So as you can see, there is a really nice balance between humor of the story and a genuine sincerity of the story. So I think it's a real treat, and it would be perfect for a Christmas concert or an assembly. So go to the website, www.theaterfolk.com, for The First Herald Angel, read the sample pages, buy it, Now, yes, buy it in November, for the Christmas season has just begun for 2 months. Love it. Lastly, where oh where can you find this podcast? We post new episodes every Wednesday at theaterfolk.com and on our Facebook page and Twitter. You can find us on youtube.com/theaterfolk. You can find us on the Stitcher app, and you can subscribe to TFP on iTunes. All you have to do is search on the word theaterfolk, and that is where we're going to end. Take care, my friends. Take care. Start singing Christmas carols. It's never too early, apparently.